Chapter 3, Ischemic Stroke.
So can you tell me what was it that brought you to the ER today?
I was having trouble. I was confused and I was having trouble. Having trouble.
Are you having trouble making sentences? Or are you more having trouble thinking of words?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know which it is.
When did you notice this?
This morning when I was on the telephone trying to cancel an appointment.
What happened on the phone?
I had pauses like this and they, and I would try and bring it back together and then it would come back and I would try to think or try to grasp what, you know, what I was trying to say. And so I could just stop. And I wasn't even aware. It's like I wasn't aware it stopped. It just stopped.
How were you doing yesterday?
Yesterday I was fine. No problems yesterday.
And then I'm going to just do what we did a minute ago, where I'm touching your right arm
mm-hmm.
and your left arm.
Mm-hmm.
And do they feel the same?
No.
What do you feel? Do you feel less on one side?
Less on one side than on the other.
And what about your legs? When I did the same thing on your legs?
Yeah, it's a difference on my legs. It's less on the left, on the right side than on the left side.
So let me run down that list of the things that you should go through when you're assessing a stroke patient. The first one was to manage their airway. Clearly, we don't need to intubate this patient. Second was finding out the time of onset. And for her, it was about 90 minutes ago. On rapid exam, she has clearly a word-finding difficulty. And she also has decreased sensation and a motor weakness on the right side of her body. That's both her arm and her leg. So she's got a little bit of drift in her arm and her leg, or 4 out of 5 strength. And then just a difference in sensation where the right side feels less to her compared with the left side. Her glucose is 124 and her blood pressure is 140 over 90. So we're going to get her to CAT scan. She's cleared basically to go to CT scan. And Stuart, I want to know what your prediction is of where this patient's lesion is.
So Jess, her lesion localizes to the left cerebral hemisphere, specifically to the territory of the middle cerebral artery territory. And that's because she has right-sided weakness and sensory findings. So that goes with a cortical lesion on the left. And also because the language is affected. And so she has trouble finding words. And that also goes with a cortical problem on the left side, the left brain. And so you might not see any of that on the CT initially, because if it's an early CT, you remember that you don't see signs of ischemia right away. But if it's hemorrhagic, you might see hemorrhage right away in that territory. And so those are the things that I'd be thinking about as she's moving down to CT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. So now we're going to be talking about ischemic strokes. We just talked about hemorrhagic strokes. And forever and ever and ever, there was really nothing we could do more than just the basics. Check the glucose. Yes, you've had a stroke. Here's where it is. Ain't much we can do for your ischemic stroke. Sorry very much. Then came along thrombolytic therapy for stroke, and now we're into the interventional therapies where they go and take clots out. But remember that this is very controversial. One, that it's only for a very select subset of patients. Those subset of patients must have no bleed in their brain and must be able to be given this drug generally less than 3 hours. We talked about sometimes maybe less than 4.5 hours. And we're not even sure it works in those people. But again, that's standard practice at a lot of places. So you should do this fast. And then you should follow the protocols in your hospital. But it's been frustrating for people for a long time. And that's why there's a lot of people that really like this thing about giving thrombolytics, because there's not much else that you can do. Jess and Stuart, continue.
Okay, so let's say you get the CT and it is negative. It doesn't show any bleeding. And presumably then she's having a stroke in that left hemisphere that we talked about. You don't see anything.
So I should jump in here and just tell you that it's not obvious, but the most common thing you find on CT with somebody with an infarction stroke, a ischemic stroke, early on, is nothing. That's what you expect to see. This person clearly has a stroke clinically. I get a CT in those first few hours. I'm not expecting to see anything. If it's a giant one, I might see some edema. I might see some other stuff. If I get some other special tests and special MRIs, I can see stuff early. But on CT scanning early, the most common thing you're going to see is nothing. And you're really doing that CT to make sure there's no blood or tumor or something else which could produce the symptoms.
This is a time when you should pause and think to yourself, okay, now we're talking about TPA. We're talking about she's in the window, the CT doesn't show bleeding, we're going to give TPA. Could this be a mimic? Could we be making a mistake? And so I think in this particular case, I'm pretty comfortable with the classic presentation. She's got the speech deficit, which is sort of classic. She's got the unilateral weakness, which makes total sense with her deficit. It all kind of adds up into a classic stroke presentation. So I'm not that worried about a mimic. I'm going to quickly go through in my mind, you know, is the sugar okay? Have I considered big things like liver disease, kidney disease, dissection, things that could really interfere with me giving TPA? But other than that, I'm pretty sure that if she doesn't have exclusion criteria, that I'm going to be quickly going towards administering the therapy. Which brings us to the next question, Jess, the tough question. Are you going to give TPA to her?
Yeah, well, she is within the time window. She's about 90 minutes into the onset of her symptoms. And even though she has somewhat of a low NIH stroke score, which I'm going to go through, actually. So she's an NIH stroke score of 4. She loses a point for motor of the right arm, a point for motor of the right leg, 1 point for sensory, and 1 point for dysarthria. So that's an NIH stroke scale of 4. I would still be considering her for TPA. So you want to make sure every single time before you even have a conversation with the patient and their family about the risks and the benefits of TPA that you're making sure they don't have an exclusion criteria. So the patient goes to a CT scan, and we get both a non-contrast CT followed by a CT angiogram, and these both come back negative and no large vessel occlusion.
And so that would be consistent with an ischemic stroke, right? You don't actually like to see things. Like if you see edema and changes, it makes you worried that it's been going on for longer than the patient's reporting, right? So it's kind of the perfect situation to give TPA in an ischemic stroke. But we have to kind of pause for one moment and make sure that this really is a stroke at this point in time, because we're about to give TPA, right? If they're in the window, we're going to give TPA unless there's a contraindication. And so this is sort of the time that you should be thinking about your stroke mimics. But in this particular case, she's got the speech, which is kind of classic for the cortical stroke. It goes along with the contralateral weakness and sensory findings. It all kind of makes total sense for a stroke. So I'm not as worried about a mimic in this case. To be honest with you, the thing that I'm most worried about is to make sure that there's not some surgical cause of her stroke, like an aortic dissection is the thing that kind of runs through my mind every time in this case, because I don't want to be giving them TPA. So I don't think there's a high chance there's a stroke mimic going on here, but that still doesn't mean you shouldn't give pause before you give TPA. Think about the etiology too.
I'm not going to go through every single exclusion criteria, but you should pull up a list every single time, either online, on MDCalc, if you have cards, whatever you use, make sure you go through every single one. But in general, if they've had a major bleed in their past, like they've had a hemorrhagic stroke, or if they've recently had some sort of major bleed, whether it's a GI bleed or an arterial puncture, then you're not going to be able to give them TPA. So let's go back to our patient and let's listen for any exclusion criteria that she might have.
What's your medication you're on?
I'm on metformin. I'm on tramadol. Atorvastatin, Losartan, and vitamin D.
What's the blood thinner you're on?
Oh, Coumadin. I'm on Coumadin also.
And why do you take that?
Because I had a pulmonary embolism.
So the wrench here is that this patient is on warfarin, Coumadin. So she's anticoagulated, which means that we need to check her INR before we give her TPA, because if it's greater than 1.7, then that's actually an exclusion criteria for receiving TPA. So we check her INR, it's 2.2. So this patient is not a TPA candidate, unfortunately. But there are some things that we do need to talk about for people who you are going to consider for TPA. So people who you would want to consider for TPA, they don't have any of the exclusion criteria, and they do have an NIH stroke score between 3 and 25. And 25 is getting pretty high up there, where the risk for hemorrhagic conversion increases for those really high NIH stroke scores. But sometimes patients have a low NIH stroke score, and you still want to consider them for tPA because maybe they lose a point for something like aphasia, which is really debilitating, and they may still have some benefit from treatment for that. And there's actually a great discussion on this exact topic, the possibility of giving tPA to low NIH stroke scores, and it's from MRAP October 2017 with Rob Orman and John Schrock. So you could take a listen to that for more details.
You know, consent and counseling when you're talking about tPA administration in the emergency department is a big deal. And that's because unlike some other therapies that we have, the potential downside of tPA is huge. They can have life-threatening bleeding from it. And so I think it's important for patients to know that and to put that into context in terms of the flip side, which is the benefit in their long-term prognosis. Now, it's ideal to obviously have a patient consent for their own therapy, but there's a lot of difficulty in stroke patients because sometimes we think that they understand the consent process when they really don't because of the stroke, and vice versa. They're having some problem with dysarthria, but they really understand completely what's going on, and we think they don't. And so I think it's good to keep an open mind that you might be getting this wrong, and that means whenever possible, you also have to have others involved in the process. That's why it's really helpful to have the family there when you're having that discussion as well, I think, because of those potential communication issues.
If you're going to administer tPA, then the goal door to needle time is 60 minutes. So it's a tight time window. You got to get your initial assessment. You got to get the CT scan, an interpretation of the CT scan. And then you have to sit down with the patient and hopefully their family and do the whole consent process. And the goal is to do that within 60 minutes at the most. So if you're giving tPA, you're giving it both as a bolus and then the rest is administered over the course of 1 hour. And you're doing this hopefully with the consultation of an ED pharmacist, if you have one.
Now, once the tPA has been administered, are patients at risk? Are patients at risk for hemorrhage and specifically hemorrhagic conversion of the stroke that we're treating? And the bigger the stroke, the higher the NIH score, generally speaking, the higher that risk of bleeding. So that means close observation of the nursing staff. That means frequent neuro checks to see if there's any change in their exam. Any headache, extremely important to know about that. If any of those things happen, we immediately stop the tPA infusion, get that patient re-imaged with another CT, and we got to think right away about the possibility that if it's a hemorrhagic conversion, we're going to need to reverse them. And so that usually involves giving cryoprecipitate and other IV agents right away. Another thing that we're watching for when we're observing them is angioedema. I actually haven't seen this personally, but a documented side effect of tPA is an angioedema. It's not like you can do a lot about that necessarily if it's happening other than manage their airway in the way that you normally would.
And then a lot of the other things that we're going to do are going to be the same stuff, thankfully, that you're doing for the hemorrhagic strokes. You're going to elevate the head of the bed 30 degrees. Again, that's because we want to reduce the chance that the patient is going to aspirate. And the other reason is because you want to increase the venous drainage of the brain. Blood pressure control is also very important. We'll come back to that in just a moment. You want to maintain their oxygen saturation greater than 94%, so just put them on some supplemental oxygen if needed. You're going to give them an aspirin if you're not giving them tPA. If you're giving tPA, then you don't have to give the aspirin. And then you're going to make the patient NPO. All patients with a stroke, they need a swallow assessment before they're allowed to have anything by mouth because they're all at risk for aspiration. But let's go back to the blood pressure for just a moment, because I think this is a point of confusion for a lot of people. For an ischemic stroke, on one hand, you want to let that blood pressure ride high to increase cerebral perfusion. But on the other hand, there's some cases when it's really important that we manage the blood pressure at least a little bit. And that's, Stuart, more for people who are getting tPA, right?
That's exactly right. So for people that are getting tPA, the risk is bleeding, and we know that that is intimately tied to high blood pressures. And so if you happen to give tPA, you're going to make sure that that blood pressure stays below what the guidelines say, 180 over 105, because of their bleeding risk. And that's something you got to watch pretty carefully. You're going to have them on a titratable agent and be able to intervene right away if the blood pressure creeps above that limit.
And that's why one of the first things that you're checking is the blood pressure for the patient, because if they potentially are a tPA candidate, and the only exclusion criteria that they have is blood pressure, then you can treat their blood pressure with something like labetalol or nicardipine and bring it down. And then as long as they're less than that 180 over 105 goal, then you can give them tPA.
But it's also important to recognize that in patients that you're not giving tPA to, that There is no reason to lower that blood pressure, and it might in fact be dangerous.
So let's summarize this. Hemorrhagic strokes, you lower the blood pressure because you don't want them to continue to bleed. Ischemic strokes, think of it in two categories. Patients who are getting TPA, sort of like the patients with a hemorrhagic stroke, they're at risk for bleeding, for hemorrhagic conversion. So we want to control their blood pressures. And then the third category is patients with ischemic strokes who are not getting TPA. And those are the ones that you let the blood pressure rise higher.
That's right, Jess. If you're not giving TPA to these patients, the idea is not to lower their blood pressure. In fact, the AHA guidelines say that unless the blood pressure is 220 systolic, that we're supposed to cease and desist, leave the blood pressure high. And the reason for that in ischemic strokes is that because in a lot of these patients, there's a big area around the stroke, around the infarcted tissue, that is merely at risk. Typically in patients that are used to pretty high blood pressure over the course of their lifetimes until this event. And so if you precipitously lower their blood pressure, you might cause additional areas to die around the core of your infarct. And that's why still to this day, unless we're giving TPA, we let blood pressure ride high in the first few hours in the emergency department course of an acute ischemic stroke.
So I'm going to say it one more time because I think this is really confusing. So the blood pressure goals one more time. If it's a hemorrhagic stroke, then the target is somewhere between 140 and 180 systolic. And that's going to vary depending on where you work and what your specialists prefer. If it is an ischemic stroke in a patient who is receiving TPA, the target blood pressure is less than 180 over 105. And for an ischemic stroke that is not receiving TPA, the blood pressure goal is less than 220 over 120. And you just let it ride up until that point. And we mentioned it earlier, but with all of these, it's really important that you're involving your neurologist or your neurointerventionalist, your neurosurgeon in the decisions of how you're managing the blood pressure.
That's right, because this is such a quickly moving area and there's a lot of experts out there with a lot of opinions. So rather than being totally dogmatic, you have the general concepts of who we're going to lower and who we're not. But it's really important to get on the same page and chart in your documentation that you're discussing the blood pressure with the consultants and that you have agreed on a target range. I think that's really important because of the fast-moving nature of this area.
So when it comes to supplemental oxygen, I said before you want to maintain that O2 sat above 94% because you really don't want the brain-injured patient or spinal cord-injured patient, for that matter, to have hypoxia. Oxygen's in really high demand. So unlike the patient with the acute MI, where we're really trying to not make them hyperoxic, and we're not here either, you really want to make sure that the patient is not desaturating. And then when it comes to aspirin, so if the patient is not receiving TPA and they have an ischemic stroke, they are getting aspirin. You give them all aspirin. And if they can't swallow, because they're dysarthric and they haven't passed their swallow study, they're getting a rectal aspirin.
Hoo-ah!
But they're all getting aspirin.
Ah.
When it comes to patients who are getting TPA, you can hold the aspirin. Actually, that's the current AHA recommendation, is that you hold aspirin if you're giving TPA, because it may increase the risk of spontaneous intracranial hemorrhage. And really, the reason why we're giving aspirin is to decrease the chance of an early recurrent stroke.
So when a patient goes to the CT scanner suite to get their non-contrast CT, you're suspecting that there's a stroke. If it's a negative CT for blood, the next step is often an angiogram, a CT angiogram, to see whether or not there's a large vessel occlusion that can be addressed with interventional therapies. And Jess, this is in addition to the possibility of giving them IV TPA. If they meet the criteria and they're in the window, IV TPA is still the first point in therapy. But then after that, if there was a large vessel occlusion identified on the angiogram that they had initially, they might be candidates for further therapy after the IV TPA, like endovascular therapy, having a clot removed with the stent retriever device. And those are things that patients are eligible for after the 3 or 4.5 hour window, all the way up until several hours after their stroke.
I always thought that was kind of funny because one of the contraindications for TPA is a recent arterial puncture. And here we are giving TPA actively, and they're possibly going for an arterial puncture for a thrombectomy.
But we do it through the groin so that it's a compressible site.
And there's further discussion on this exact subject in EMA from October 2017 in Abstract 10 on combined thrombolysis and thrombectomy for acute ischemic stroke. And one last thing to mention about large territory ischemic strokes is what to do if that patient is on an anticoagulant like warfarin.
Yeah, this can get really tricky, and to some extent, it depends on why they're on the anticoagulant. But regardless of why they're on it, if they have a huge territory of stroke and they're on anything that's going to increase their bleeding risk, they're really sitting ducks to bleed into that stroke and have a hemorrhagic transformation. And so for cases of large stroke in patients that are not getting TPA, a discussion should be had with the inpatient service as to whether or not you're going to do anything to reverse their anticoagulation. It can be very tricky. There's many ways to do it, but it's something that has to come up really early in the conversation.
Now, another thing that comes up really frequently, as we know, Stuart, is a patient who has stroke symptoms, but their time of onset cannot be established because the symptoms were present when they woke up, and we call that a wake-up stroke. The issue with the wake-up stroke is that you don't know if the patient had the stroke 10 minutes before they woke up or right after they fell asleep. So perhaps they are still within the window and we just simply don't know. So it's not to the patient's advantage to just simply consider them as a stroke that's outside the window. So Stuart, tell us how we can use imaging to help decide whether or not the patient is a candidate for interventional procedures.
So what the concept is here is that when you do the non-contrast scan, if there's no signs of edema, any evolution of a stroke, that's a good sign. That supports that it hasn't been that long since the stroke. And then what some people will do is add a CT perfusion study on top of that to see that there's a large area of penumbra, ischemic penumbra, and use those as a surrogate instead of the time for giving TPA. So this is what a lot of people are doing.
So working in consultation with your neurointerventionalist, even though it's a wake-up stroke, if you have a CT perfusion scan that shows that they may still benefit from an intervention, then you should have that conversation with your consultant. And then, you know, I think something needs to be said about strokes outside the TPA window, because I've heard several residents and junior learners basically say like, oh, well, this patient had their stroke, but it was yesterday, so we're not going to do anything for them, so they could probably go home. And it's like, no, stop. There is so much that we're going to do for them.
That's exactly right. And, you know, so much of the conversation gets occupied by this whole TPA question that we forget that the evidence shows us that we're saving lives in stroke care, not really just with TPA. In fact, TPA isn't really a big part of it. The saving of lives is the nursing care. It's the elevating the head of the bed. It's keeping the patient NPO until a swallowing study is done. It's preventing them from having a fever. It's looking after any concurrent medical problems that they have, controlling their blood sugar. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but it's this good basic medical care that makes all the difference. So if we turn our brains off once that TPA question is over, we're really not doing any favors for this patient.
Okay, Jess and Stuart just covered an enormous amount of ground, and I'm going to try and sort of simplify it without waffling on for too long. So a patient comes in, we think they have a stroke clinically, we get a quick history, quick exam, we get a glucose, we start some labs going, but we get them to the scanner fast. We get them to the scanner fast because time is brain. If you can work out that this person has a ischemic stroke and they've got no contraindications, in most places in the United States, they are going to get thrombolytic therapy. Now, we can disagree about whether that's right or wrong, but for now, as a new sort of learner, that's what's going to happen. That time frame is generally less than 3 hours, so you've got to go fast. Now, there was another time frame you heard in there, less than an hour from when you see them to when you start the drug. So that's sort of a suggestion about how quick you should be able to get the scanner and get the history and the physical and everything done before you give your thrombolytic therapy. So time is brain. All right. Now, what are the other things that you can do for these patients who have had an ischemic stroke? The same kind of stuff. We'll get their oxygenation around 94. We don't know exactly what it should be, but somewhere around there is about right. And that means for most people, you don't need to do anything. Elevate that head of the bed. Okay, so that's great. Get that drainage away. Treat any seizures if they occur. Okay, that's fine. Aspirin. If you're not giving TPA, you give aspirin. Aspirin is quite effective and it reduces subsequent strokes as well. But aspirin plus TPA is bad. So if you're giving TPA, we don't give aspirin. Blood pressure control is where it gets a little bit confusing, because if you're giving TPA, you don't want that blood pressure too high. You want it less than 180 on 105. Labetalol or one of the calcium channel blockers, depending on what's used at your place, it's fine. We bring that blood pressure down. If you're not giving TPA, then that high blood pressure might actually be the body's response to try and perfuse some of that ischemic area around the stroke. So we generally leave it alone unless it's really high. If it's over sort of the 220s, we may want to bring it down a little bit, although we're really not that sure, to be honest. And if they're outside the time window, or if they've got a contraindication to thrombolytic therapy, there's still a lot you can do for these patients, but that lot is mostly aspirin if there's not a contraindication, and then admission to a stroke unit. Stroke units where they really take good care of these patients, they follow protocols, they look after their patients' blood pressure, they do swallowing studies, they do all that stuff. That's much, much better, actually, overall, much, much better than the reduction in morbidity or mortality from anything like thrombolytic therapy. Now, thrombolytic therapy for stroke is controversial, but in a lot of places, it's now sort of standard care. And you should follow a checkbox system because there are so many contraindications to the drug. There are so many things you've got to do. There's so much about this that's hard, and this is where protocol medicine is useful. I think the person's had a stroke, IVO2 monitor, airway breathing, circulation, get that set about 94%, head of the bed up 30 degrees, check that glucose, send them to the scanner. Okay, there doesn't look like there's anything bad on that scanner. Do they have any contraindications? There's a big long list. Let me go through that list. That's really how you've got to do this. And generally, you're going to be doing this with a team of people. And then if they're outside the stroke thrombolytic time frame, there's other stuff that can be done. There is stuff like we go up there and we pull the clot out if it's big, if it's in the right place. There's some special imaging that you might have to do. That's outside sort of your expertise at that point once you've done the basics. Do the basics well and get help and follow your protocol for your hospital and you're going to be okay. But the basics in this are actually pretty simple.